Simple Beep, episode 39, the iMac G3. Hello, and welcome to Simple Beep, a podcast about the history of Apple and the Mac community. I'm Ed Cormony.
And I'm Brian Sartorius.
And we have a special guest with us for this episode. Welcome back to the show, Stephen Hackett.
Hey guys, how are y'all?
Good. And the reason that we have you here is because you did a ridiculous thing, which is that you started out from Pallet Town with nothing but a level one Sage iMac, and you have now conquered the entire universe and the Elite Four and have completed your Pokedex of iMacs, all 13 of them. And so you have a lot of primary experience with the iMac G3 recently, and we figured it would be good to talk with you about that and go through kind of the whole history of the G3 iMac.
Yeah, most of my firsthand experience is being really sore after moving them around because I had to move them from my house. Yeah, there's a bunch of them, and we'll get into it, but it's kind of a crazy history. Like it's not as clean cut as I thought it was when I decided like a month and a half ago that I should find them all.
Yeah, I think one of the first things that you posted was an image from Wikipedia that has just like little thumbnails of these are the 13 flavors of iMac. And it makes it seem really small and contained and straightforward.
It's none of those things.
None of those things. Definitely not small. I mean, did you eventually just have them start shipping them to the office instead of home?
No, I mean, I would have. There's some logistics with that, with this building, but we were talking before, like my UPS and FedEx guy, like definitely deserve a Christmas present for me this year. Cause the early ones are like 40 something pounds, like 41 pounds a piece. And by the time you pack them, a lot of them came with keyboards and mice, and someone sent me, I think with my Blueberry, came with a bunch of like old, like iMac for Dummies books. It just like, all it's doing, like, is just weighing the box down.
And you had a couple that came in original packaging too, right?
I just had one. The Tangerine came in an original box, which was super cool. I'd never seen an original box. I had never seen the original documentation and the booklets that came with it. So that was really special. And that one is probably my favorite color. And so it was fun to see it like as it came from the factory.
Yeah, we've talked about the iMac G3 a little bit before on the show. And one of the things I know that we've pointed out was one of the original videos was the Simplicity Shootout video that was supposed to show how easy it was to set up the iMac. And it pits, you know, a regular businessman type with against a kid and his dog. And there's one scene in that video where there's just kind of a very graceful cut where the iMac goes from in the box to out of the box. Because I'm guessing that the computer more or less outweighed the kid.
It would have crushed that child. I have kids about that age. They would be dead.
So before we get into the overall history of the iMac, you know, the iMac G3 is the first iMac. And so we're going to be covering the first bit of the arc of the iMac's history. But of course, it's an arc that is continuing to this day. I figured that we should just maybe mention quickly where each of us sort of came into having an experience with the iMac. And I guess I'll start. And we kind of missed the iMac G3 boat in some ways. So I never lived in a home that had an iMac G3 in it because we got a G3 desktop beige. I think it was a 233 megahertz G3 desktop. It was not like a pizza box configuration. It was much thicker than that.
Yeah.
Just a very standard beige 6-inch thick desktop. And I remember that, you know, this was what computers, including Macs, looked like just prior to the iMac. So it was in 1997 that machine came out. And my family got that. Our first Mac was like the very first Power Mac, 6100. And then this was the first, you know, entry level of the new generation with the G3 processors. And so it was a big upgrade for us. We were very happy with that computer. It lasted years and years. But it was the kind of thing where you got like kind of a special computer desk, and it would have compartments and stuff. And many of them had like the tower compartment down on the side. And we didn't have a tower, so you stacked like CDs and stuff in there. But the way that we had that machine set up was that the CPU unit, you know, the entire computer basically, except the monitor and the peripherals, was stashed at like foot level. It was on the lowest shelf of the desk because, you know, every once in a while you had to pop a disc in there or something, but you didn't really want to see it because it was nothing to look at. So we kind of missed out on the very beginning of the iMac era. The first iMac that was in my family at all was an Indigo iMac that my grandpa got to replace his aging, dying Performa, which never properly worked right. I think I've mentioned that on the show before, too. He got like a bum monitor that would turn funny colors and you had to literally smack it to get it to work right. So that was the first iMac that I used on any sort of regular basis, was kind of a couple years into the iMac's life.
My family had a fourth revision, Revision D, Blueberry tray loading CD iMac. And it got to stay in my bedroom because I got all A's in middle school. And we were upgrading from a Performa 6100 series. So I think like the same like jump that you had, Ed, from like you had a PowerMac 6100.
Yeah.
To a G3. Yeah. And so we basically went from the same machine to a G3.
Basically like two processor architectures.
Yeah. And so it like was almost my primary machine, except it was also the, like the family internet machine. So people would come into my bedroom to like check email and stuff. But it was like the coolest thing. I remember loving every bit about it. And so, yeah, I think we'll get into the certain details that we loved about it later in the show.
Yeah, and that was actually basically my first experience with the iMac, was using your iMac, Brian.
playing like Rainbow Six and stuff.
Yeah, and I remember that. Just that was my first experience with the hardware. This hardware that looked like no other computer that I had ever used, even though I had been using Macs for years and years. And we'll get into things like the Puck Mouse and all of that. But that was the first time that I laid hands on it. And my memory of that was that I thought that it was an original Bondi Blue, as we have learned how to pronounce that particular bit of Australian geography.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was one of the original ones, just thinking back on it. But now you've gone back and sort of pieced it all together and realized it was the Blueberry, which is slightly different.
Slightly, yeah.
But you said that, you know, it's tied to middle school. I mean, this, you know, puts it in historical context for us. And one thing that this is a little bit of follow-up too, I guess. Stephen, you had written about this a little while ago and actually did an interview over on Connected about the Apple One that the Ford Museum here in Michigan has.
Yeah.
And I unfortunately didn't make it over to Dearborn to actually go and see it in person. I had seen some photos that were posted online and it looked kind of like, well, here's a circuit board in a case. And then a little bit later, like right before it went back into storage, a listener and fellow Ann Arborite, Marina Eppelman, posted some photos. She went down to the Ford Museum and looked through the exhibits there. And it looks like they really have some awesome technology curation exhibits. And she posted one photo that we'll link in the show notes that had a case. It was like a glass display case. And it was like the perfect microcosm of my 7th grade, 8th grade year. It was like, that is 1998, because it had an original iMac in it. It had Pokemon Red and Blue cartridges in it. It had a pair of rollerblades. Like, it was spot on. They just took my entire middle school experience and put it behind glass.
Yeah, for me, it was middle school as well. We had, you know, a computer lab that had some iMacs in it. I couldn't tell you which ones they were, you know, we were only in there every couple of weeks. But in high school, so this would have been in 2001, 2002, the high school newspaper got some hand-me-down iMac G3s. And to that point, we were using all beige Macs, including my beloved but often maligned PowerMac G3 all-in-one. And we got a couple of tray-loading iMacs of, you know, various colors. And I just remember, you know, kind of like you're talking about the G3 desktop, like, this was something obviously so very different, and it really, you know, that machine, like I think I spoke about last time I was on here, like that high school newspaper experience is what brought me to the Mac, and like the iMac is at the heart of that story. Like as much as the all-in-one was sort of the first machine I used, the iMac was the first machine that sort of spoke to me on a different level. And I think that's true for a lot of people, like definitely people our age, right? We were in our formative kind of years, you know, becoming, you know, older students, having more independence, having a computer in our room. Like the iMac was right in there for a lot of us. And I think that's one reason that I find them so special is that, you know, they come from that era when I first met the Mac.
Yeah, I knew that you would bring up the Mueller Mac. And I think that that's actually kind of a good transition into getting into the iMac launch, because the fact of the matter is that being an all-in-one Mac was not the special thing about the iMac. Obviously, the first Macintosh was an all-in-one machine, and that was maybe as revolutionary then as the iMac was, you know, some 13 years later. But this was a design that Apple had considered and tried and worked on for a long time. And the Mueller Mac, the G3 all-in-one, is that one that just kind of lands smack in the uncanny valley of, we had a really great idea here and we kind of had a vision and we just didn't quite get to it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So let's go to the launch of the original iMac, and we'll take a tour through the various revisions of the iMac G3, which is a history that spans about, it's actually relatively short, maybe 3-4 years, but this was a period that, you know, the reason that this is so fascinating is that it was the period where Apple came back. This was the machine that saved Apple. I mean, Stephen, you've said that that's the reason why you feel so passionate about the iMac G3 and why you want to write about it and talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Jobs comes in right for the next acquisition. And the first thing they do very famously is they can a lot of products. And then he lays out the grid of four. We're going to have desktop and notebook, professional, consumer. And he starts filling in those blocks. And for a long time, the notebook consumer was just empty because the iBook didn't come along till much later. But it's, you know, it is a really clear message. And he actually kind of leads off with that in this keynote where the iMac gets introduced. But it's a very, unlike today where I think the lines are a little bit grayer, it was very clear in 1998, if you are this kind of user, this is the kind of computer we would like you to buy. And I think it really fit that peg really well.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because the kind of computer that my family was buying was, we were, before the grid of two, we've talked about this also, was the line of three, which was the Pro Go Whoa. So that was before there was the consumer laptop. You just had the pro desktops, the portables, and the consumer desktops, which were going to be filled in with the iMacs. And before that, my family, we never felt like we fit in the consumer desktop space, especially as it was in the beige Mac consumer desktop space. It was the Performa, which was usually some other machine that was then kind of watered down to get part costs down and then backfilled with a binder full of CDs that was supposed to make it family friendly. And that didn't really make a compelling consumer offering. And so what we wound up going for in those first two Macs that we had was, we're like, okay, we need a pro Mac, but they're expensive. So we need to buy like the bottom of the line pro Mac. So it makes sense that that market was there to kind of shift down to have not go all the way to the bottom of the line consumer, but to go into a luxury consumer product, which was the kind of thing that Apple needed to sell and was what they got in the original iMac.
Yeah, watching back this keynote, the introduction of the original iMac, a lot of time is dedicated to the G3 processor and how much better and faster it is than the Pentium 2 at the time. And so it's kind of like one of the big bombshells of the iMac announcement is like, yes, we've established that we're doing this consumer versus professional grid. And our consumer machine, that's right, it has the same processor as our professional machine. And so it really is like, you know, in appearances, it's certainly more of a mainstream appeasing design, but like it was, I think, the first one that like definitely had the power, where maybe the power specs a little bit blurred the lines between consumer and professional.
And that's a trick that Apple has pulled several times since. I mean, think about recently, just in the past few years, they're like, oh yeah, and there's a new iPad mini and it like outspecs all but one of the other iPads.
Or the iPhone SE has the same processor as the flagship 6S Plus, essentially.
So let's get into the announcement. And of course, the big reveal with the iMac was going to be its design, because it was something that nobody had ever seen before, but it also had some callback features.
So it had an introductory video, which after the big reveal was actually played on the iMac screen, just like the original Macintosh introduction. And it even called back to the like final graphic, where on the original Macintosh, it had that script hello. And on the iMac, it said that same script hello. And then in Apple's corporate Garamond font at the time, again, in parentheses underneath it.
Lots of tiebacks to the original Macintosh, of course, because this was the first, well, sorry, Stephen, first kind of serious all-in-one Macintosh that Apple had put out in a while. There were some of the, geez, I don't even know which line they came under. There were Performas or maybe like Quadra AVs that were kind of all-in-one.
Late model LCs, Performas.
Yeah, some of the LCs when they went past LC 1, 2, and 3 into giving them like four-digit model numbers like everything else. And of course, this product that they were unveiling also didn't have some kind of awful model number. It had just its name, iMac. But that almost didn't come to pass, as it turns out. This was revealed a little bit later on with a fantastic article that we'll link in the show notes. This is over on Fast Company, called Steve Jobs Almost Named the iMac the Mac Man Until This Guy Stopped Him. And this article was just posted in 2012. So some good history there. And this was something, a little bit of the iMac's prehistory that I had more or less forgotten. And the article is full of great quotes and behind the scenes stories from that. You know, the people who are charged with marketing this computer. And MacMan was apparently an invention of Phil Schiller. And Steve Jobs loved it and said, this is the name unless you come up with something better. And they're like, boy, we can come up with something better. And then they came up with all kinds of different ideas. And he's like, no, I think it should be MacMan. And the people who were trying to come up with better branding said that, you know, the name gave them hives. And yeah, just so many things wrong with that. I just immediately think of Pac-Man, and I can see like little side views of the colorful CRTs just going wah, 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 wah.
Oh yeah.
So they ended up sticking an eye in front of it. And what's interesting, one of maybe the most interesting slides in this keynote to me, is when Jobs says this is what the I stands for. And, you know, instead of the one thing, internet, which is kind of the one that has survived, it's internet, individual, instruct, inform, and inspire. It's like, it's not as tight marketing wise as Apple would become later. But of course, now the I, you know, it doesn't stand for internet phone or internet pad, right? It has become just a thing. The I just become its own entity. But you know, clearly those were words and those were ideas that Apple wanted to infuse this product with. That, of course, yes, it's really easy to get on the internet. They had the very famous there's no step three, there's no step three ad.
Step three is Earthlink.
Yeah. Oh gosh. but you know, the putting in a classroom, giving people the tools to create. The individual one, I think, comes true later when they sort of add the additional colors, but it's just a very interesting little, and it kind of sticks out to me now, you know, so many years later, that instead of just one message, there's kind of five little messages wrapped up in that one letter.
Yeah. And it's funny that, you know, it has lost, it's gained a different sort of meaning. I mean, we think of it as like, oh, it's a prefix that goes on Mac, just this little letter I, but, I'll put in my little obligatory linguistics lesson here, is that, you know, if you think about the morphemes, the pieces of words, like the definition for that in linguistics is you've got a unit of sound that matches up with a unit of meaning. And so at the original launch of the iMac, the meaning was kind of undefined. What does that I stand for? Well, it stands for kind of five different things at once. So it hasn't really come to be a true prefix, something that means something, piece of a word. But now that it's applied to so many other things, that the iPod, now the iPad, iCloud, it's a general purpose prefix. And what is that meaning of just the I? It means this belongs to Apple.
Another thing that's interesting about this sort of serves as a template for later product announcements by Steve. And so he talks a little bit about what other consumer products are out there. He makes fun of all the PCs with all their cables and beige boxes, even though that's what Apple was selling to their professional customers. We'll just put that aside. And, you know, he says, you know, they're slow, they have small displays. And he says, with the iMac, we're going to solve all of that stuff. We're going to have a nice big display. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be well-designed. And it's going to be easy to set up and easy to use. And I think what's important, and he doesn't say it, but it's woven all throughout his messaging, is that this computer is not threatening. I mean, sort of it falling on you, which all computers were heavy then, the iMac is not, doesn't look like something that could hurt you or that you could mess up by using it, right? It's not confrontational. It's something that looks very friendly. That ties back to the original Mac, that it looks like your buddy on the desk, right? It doesn't look like some big, scary, angular machine. And he kind of goes into all of that. And then we get to the big reveal.
And really, like, I don't know what more we can say about the reveal other than, like, everyone's minds were blown. It's all the different things that have been said about the original iMac over the years. Like, I think a common one is it's the computer from the Jetsons, or like a fish tank, or a candy, jelly beans, jelly bellies. It redefined what a computer could look like in all the ways that were just said here too. Like, it's friendly, it's approachable, it's personable, it reflects personality. It's not a faceless hunk of plastic and silicon.
Well, and right in the announcement, Steve Jobs said the degree to which he thought that it was different than what anyone had seen before. And he says,
it looks like it's from another planet, and a good planet. A planet with better designers.
And I think that quote is particularly funny, especially because now, as observers of Apple since then, we know exactly who's behind that design team. And of course, it's Johnny Ive. And I think it's particularly funny, almost a little bit creepy, that he's had such a hand in the new Apple Campus 2, affectionately known as the spaceship, which maybe he'll be able to go back to his home planet sometime soon.
The white room, the white planet.
Yeah. And my favorite quote is,
the back of this thing looks better than the front of the other guys, by the way.
This keynote has just like lots of little like Steve outbursts about how much he loves the design.
But that quote is so true. I mean, every day at work, I walk past the desk of one of my coworkers, and she has an iPhone 6S Plus. And it is, for most of the day, plugged in to a lightning cable via USB directly into the front of the Windows tower that sits on her desk. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is two completely separate worlds. And yeah, the front of that computer that's sitting and doing productive work in an office in 2016 looks way worse than the side or back of the original iMac.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's continued to iMacs and really all of Apple's machines today. Like, I see at receptionist desks, almost everywhere I go, it's an iMac or an Apple like Cinema display or Thunderbolt display, because it's like a clean block of aluminum. And sure, it has a big logo on it, but like, if that's what the receptionist is using, the person coming into the office is going to see the back of that machine. So like, it actually makes sense to prioritize that area of design for applications like that.
So now let's get into actually what the iMac offered in terms of hardware. We mentioned the fact that it was bringing a slightly more professional type of specification with the G3 processor down to the consumer level. And Steven has very generously provided us with extremely detailed specifications for all of the revisions of iMacs. And so let's start with Rev A, which was released in August of 1998.
Yeah, it was running macOS 8.1, which is also another way to kind of place it in the Apple timeline.
Yeah, it was like a long time ago.
it had a graphics card, which was a big step up, certainly for my family. That's why my early memories of it were playing games like Rainbow Six, which had 4 megs of VRAM.
You can't even draw one triangle with that today.
I know. Doesn't run Crysis, though. No, it doesn't. And a 256 megabyte RAM ceiling and a 4 gigabyte hard drive.
You know, it seems now, I mean, obviously, time has moved on and these specs seem rather funny now, right? But I mean, if you look at like that G3 desktop, speed is in the same neighborhood. You know, the RAM ceiling it's lower, but kind of in line maybe if you're looking at professional versus consumer usage. And the hard drive is, you know, relatively in the same kind of bracket of storage space. And so this wasn't kind of like how we think of Apple now. Like, it was a consumer product, but it was not like basement level parts and basement level pricing, right? This was an expensive machine, and for the time, for a consumer machine even, it was less than the Power Max, but you got a real computer as opposed to something that was so stripped down that you would have to upgrade it to use it, or you would just be hamstrung.
Yeah, comparing these specs to the G3 desktop that I used for many, many years, it's basically the same. They've basically done the consumerization of the entry level of their current generation of hardware. So same CPU, 233 megahertz, the same storage, 4 gigs. And so it was really just a repackaging, although of course there were some things that were famously missing and some famous additions. So the famously missing would be the floppy drive.
Yep.
Any way that you had to move files before this computer didn't work anymore. Like it was a very closed box unless you invested in USB floppy drives, or of course everybody remembers like zip disks and zip drives. But what's interesting too is that stuff wasn't out when this machine was announced, and it was announced in, I think, in the late spring, and then came out in the fall. And in that time period, some, you know, vendors came online and got some stuff made. And of course, they coated everything in blue plastic because that was the design at the time.
We did a whole episode on that.
Yeah.
We'll link that in the notes. Episode 23, all about all kinds of ugly things in blue plastic.
Yeah. There's a whole world of that stuff. I was looking through like old Macworlds, and like they have these big spreads of USB devices and everything is blue.
And the worst thing is, of course, that none of it matches.
Yeah.
It's all matchy-matchy clashing colors.
Yeah. They you know, they had was, I guess, like a picture in a magazine to match it by. But that was a huge deal. And even though, like, I didn't really experience that transition, I've talked to a lot of people who have. And, like, some people kind of scoffed at this machine when it was announced, saying, like, well, how do you get stuff in and out of it? And, you know, talking about Mac OS 8, like, it had, you could do file sharing and stuff, but it's nowhere near as robust as it would become even then. And SneakerNet was the way people moved files in offices and at schools and in universities and even at home. And so to have something that didn't accommodate for, you know, plugging in a disk, like that was a problem for a lot of people. And I think those people who made floppy drives made a lot of money at the beginning. But like how most of these things go, time made it better and people moved on.
Yeah, I remember in this era, we said that we were in middle school and our school had a no backpacks policy, like carrying around your stuff during the day, which was kind of disastrous. So everybody had those giant 5-star zipper binders.
Yeah.
And in the front of those, it had 3 dedicated pockets for floppy disks. And I remember that usually in there, I had 1 floppy disk and 2 zip disks like jammed in, like they weren't designed to fit in there. But that was how files got around. And the notion was now that, okay, you're going to have to leverage that eye in iMac. If you're going to be transferring files, you might need to be doing it over the internet. And with most people still on dial-up, that was really not feasible for a whole lot of stuff. I mean, I would email myself back and forth, like, you know, ClarisWorks documents. If I'm like writing an essay for school, okay, it's only 20K. Like, that's going to be a perfectly fine email attachment. But anything graphic, audio, anything that was pushing upwards towards a megabyte was getting to be too much for the infrastructure that we had to handle.
Yeah, it was a big break. And, you know, Jobs, of course, praises USB or universal serial bus, as he calls it, I think, to make people feel more comfortable. And all those virtues, you know, that came true, right? I think even a couple years into this, people were fine using USB devices. And I know by the time I ended up with one in front of me at the high school newspaper, you know, we had a file server and we had, you know, some zip drives, and it was fine. But I do think there was that transition there in 98, 99, 2000, where, you know, people really did have to like rethink their workflows, especially, you know, if you were at home and you were a single user, probably not a big deal. But if you had these in an office or in a school, it was something to think about. And I think it, you know, Apple does this, right? A lot about this iMac history gets recycled. Like, look at the MacBook today, right? It's the same kind of thing of like, I couldn't live on that machine. I need more than one port, because if you look at my desk, I have 400 things plugged in. But maybe one day that won't be the case. And it was Apple and Jobs like ramming the future down people's throats in a colorful computer.
So yeah, we talked about the USB devices that you need. Of course, one of the USB peripherals that came with the iMac were the keyboard and mouse. And we did a whole episode on keyboards. We haven't got around to mice. And of course, we should make at least brief mention of the famous hockey puck mouse that came with the original iMac. And I said that my first experiences with the iMac were in using Brian's iMac in his bedroom in middle school and high school, and basically not being able to put the cursor anywhere that I wanted to.
And I think we even at that time had the version that was dimpled on the button, so you would at least know which way to orient it when you were holding it, because the original version certainly did not.
The original or pre-release version was supposed to offer some additional features as well that were highly touted by Phil Schiller himself.
Looks like no other mouse you've ever seen before. You turn it on and it comes alive.
There was supposed to be an LED in the mouse itself to, I don't know, what, tell you that it was plugged in?
No, it, like everything about this was like, it looks cool. It's form at the sake of functionality, because a fun little detail was that this was a rollerball mouse, also a throwback like to the days where you had to take the ball out and like clean the rollers because they picked out lint. But the ball that came in, certainly the original one, and I think still in the one that we got, was two-tone. Like one hemisphere was white and one hemisphere was black, for the pure purpose of like, it's the mouse itself is translucent. So as you're rolling around, you can just see the ball move. And maybe they needed a light in there to make sure that the effect wasn't missed.
I think you're right. It's form over function. Like, and they do look good. And later on, when they introduced the five flavors, the keyboards and mice got themed to match. So I have like a tangerine mouse, you know, lime mouse, et cetera. And they all look good. I actually plugged one in and tried using it a couple of days ago just to like, was it as bad as I remember it? And I am here to tell you, it is as bad as you remember it. It's really bad. But I think the most interesting thing about this first machine is the mezzanine port. So if you look at a picture of the side of it, there's a plate, like a metal plate, and there were screws on either side. And there is a, if you unscrew it, there is a port back there. And there's only like one article on the entire internet I could find about this thing over on Macworld. And it seems to be that this was a leftover component from testing or development, and then Apple just put a plate over it. But of course, you know, people are curious, and someone pried that door off. And there were a couple of companies that made basically expansion cards. Like if you think about, you could slide in the side of a PowerBook for the iMac. There was one called Thin SCSI that basically like lets you plug in SCSI stuff into the side of your iMac. And there's another one that had to do something with storage, but it just like, it's such a weird little thing, and it went away very quickly. Like they revised the iMac and that thing is gone, but it's funny to me that shipped, and maybe something came up where they couldn't get rid of it. But it kind of reminds me of the USB port on the back of the Apple TV, which like you can plug in and do stuff, but Apple really doesn't want you to.
Yeah.
But it's just a funny little footnote to this original computer that has a strange little port on the side. If you take a screwdriver to it, you can plug this like one German-made thing into it.
Yeah, and I mentioned this to you when you shared your like slideshow animated GIF of every model, but like the ports, the I/O on the iMac really looked unfinished until you got to the slot loading things where they actually like laid it out and put it on plastic that matched the case. Like there's this weird green stretched out honeycomb pattern or something on the original iMac, and yeah, and this mezzanine slot was like a total like byproduct of what feels like a very rushed I/O port interface.
Well, again, Apple just prioritizing form and saying, this is the shape that we want this beautiful machine to be, and hack the circuit boards in any configuration that will get, you know, the ports somewhere to the outside of the machine and everything that needs to face forward facing forward. And that was the kind of design. Of course, the design being translucent also showed off the centerpiece of the iMac was its CRT display. And I presume that's another reason that the mezzanine port was kind of quickly pushed to the side, is that I remember in the days of CRT displays, televisions, monitors, all that, you were told like never, ever, ever, ever open up your monitor unless you absolutely know what you're doing, because they contain the CRT monitors contain these like really high capacity capacitors that can hold a huge amount of charge. And if you accidentally discharge them, you could kill yourself.
You could definitely get seriously hurt. I had to discharge an EMAC in genius training, and it was like the scariest thing I've ever done.
So going in to get towards that mezzanine port is, you know, cracking open the iMac and really exposing that CRT, because you could see that it was right there.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So they revved this thing very quickly, and the Revision B, it's Bondi, it looks the same. All they really did was, and this is a quote from Apple's documentation, hardware bug fixes. Like, if you want to complain about Facebook's like iOS app updates in the App Store, like software bug fixes, hardware bug fixes is the worst thing I've ever read when it comes to computing. Like, what did you do inside, and why is my Revision A garbage because of it?
Right, because if you're updating an iOS app, at least when you click the button, you get the bug fixes. If you want the Revision B bug fixes, you have to buy a whole new computer.
Yeah, I've got a Rev A. Who knows what I'm missing? But they also updated the graphics. They went from 4 to 6 megabytes of VRAM, and that lets you do some additional stuff. But really the same computer. I think if you had a Rev A and the Rev B came out, I think actually it was silent. It was only in like technical documentation, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, you're like comparing serial numbers at this point to tell which one you're getting.
Yeah, it's not a showstopper if you bought a Revision A and like 2 months later Apple revved it. Like, it's the same computer.
So maybe that's the time to move on to just 5-6 months later, where the Bondi Blue iMac goes away permanently forever.
Yep.
Because in January of 1999, Apple released the next major revision of the iMac line, the Rev C, and it comes in colors. 5 flavors, blueberry, strawberry, lime, tangerine, and grape.
Yeah, the colors are really great. And in that keynote, Steve, you know, talks about how people want to express themselves with color and with design. And he says, you know, I think we've done that. And he, there's a clip there where he's walking amongst these iMacs, which are like twirling on these pedestals. And he's like touching them all and like just saying something nice about them.
Strawberry, it's delicious.
And you can tell he's into some colors more than others. But it's really great. And having all 5 of them, like, they are a lot of fun. And I think it's where the Bondi was really special, because it was blue in a sea of beige. But the 5 flavors are even more special, because you got to pick what color you were in the sea of beige. And you know, technically under the skin, they're basically Revision B machines. They were a little bit faster. They got a little faster again with the Revision D, but it's really just you get to pick your color and go from there.
Yeah, and you have here that they got rid of the mezzanine slot, and they also got rid of the infrared receiver on the front side of the case. I know, because like what were, this was, you know, way before Front Row and an Apple remote. Like, was it for getting, if you still had a Newton or an eMate, you could beam stuff to your iMac?
Yeah. And there were some other, I think, PDAs that were using that, but it was very limited. And, I think someone, I don't remember the company, someone tried doing like a digital camera with it so you could import your photos, but IRDA was so slow. It's like, you might as well just like, like copy the bits by hand into ones and zeros. It's so slow.
Yeah. Like way slower than Bluetooth. And we know that even copying over Bluetooth is basically impractical. And if you're using Bluetooth audio, you know, the quality is low to make sure that all the bits get from point A to point B.
Yeah. I will say real quick before we move on, the blueberry color is interesting. It is, in photos, you cannot really tell the difference between it and the Bondi. If you have two of them side by side, you can. It's a little bit brighter. And some of the chassis stuff inside is slightly different. Like the band around the CRT is white as opposed to beige. But they are very, very similar. And that's kind of a problem if you're looking at buying some of these things that people don't know what they have. And so a bunch of Blueberry machines are listed Bondi and vice versa. And sometimes Indigo gets mixed in there, but those are obviously easier to spot. But of course, the other four, Strawberry, Lime, Tangerine, and Grape, are all very different from anything else they shipped. And like I said, the keyboards and mouse, the plastic inserts and stuff were all a color to match. So if you, you know, bought a Strawberry iMac, you had a pink keyboard and mouse to go with it, which I just think is a really nice touch. And you know, this is a couple years into Tim Cook being at Apple. I like to think, and this may just be complete baloney, but I like to think that that sort of like production ramp to make, like, we have to make five colors of mice and keyboard, like, that was Apple flexing that muscle really for the first time. That now, you know, they did it with iPods and they did it with iPhones and MacBooks and everything else. But this was really the first time where Apple said, you know, we can make a single product and a bunch of different SKUs with different colors, and like, and we can ship them, and we can, you can order one and you get what you want. Like, it's kind of an impressive feat from the operations side of it, kind of the way I think about it.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this today. Like, what are, if you wanted to like blow this out in inventory, you're essentially making the same machine and swapping out some pieces of colored plastic. What are all the pieces? And what I could think of were the two speaker grills, the little chiclet to open the CD tray, obviously the big shell, and then an Apple on the top and an Apple on the back.
Yep, that and the foot. So these things had four like hard feet with rubber stoppers, and then they had a plastic foot basically that you could flip up or down. It would tilt the iMac up a little bit. But yeah, that's it. I mean, everything inside and even like around the ports. I guess the port cover door, which my Lime is missing one. I think that is even the same on all of them. So it's really just a couple of pieces.
Yeah, looking at going from Bondi to the five flavors. On the Rev A, Rev B, the port door has a little blue accent, but that would be like one step too far to have another color matching piece. So it's all just the white translucent base color.
Yeah, I think that's probably why they switched. It was like, okay, like we've got to tone this down some.
Eventually, later on in the line, they would get rid of the port door because they were less ashamed of what was behind it.
Yeah, we put them in their level this time and aligned with each other.
Yeah, and maybe that's the last thing we can say about this revision of the iMac G3 is another thing that I think, was it Ed? You're like, mind blown, just realized this in 2016. But so we've been talking about the port door, which has a little like thumb hole to open and close the port door. And Apple's all about, you know, like cord management. There's like a similar hole on the back of the current iMacs and displays. And so I think my family certainly, and I bet a lot of people, threaded their cords through that like thumb hole.
But you're going to like kink the cords 90 degrees to get them through there, right?
Yeah, because the ports are spread out around the entire area. But there were cutouts at the bottom hinge in the lower left and the lower right corner for your ports, and like some to go forward, like for keyboard and mouse, and others to go backwards, like your other peripherals. And it was a total mind blown moment when me and my family realized like, oh, we're definitely doing it wrong. And then I guess I'll take the transition into the next major revision of the iMac, because like I said, we got ours after I finished middle school, which would have been the summer of 1999. And then in the fall of 1999, like arguably the biggest physical revision to the iMac G3. And it's clearly like this is the iMac they wanted to make from the beginning, kind of like how the original MacBook Air had a bunch of compromises. And then like the second major revision of the MacBook Air, still the one that's out there today, is like that's the one that they wanted to make from the start. And it's clear like this is the iMac they wanted to make from the start. There are so many different things. And I was like, man, we should have waited.
Yeah, the one thing that I notice in these is, Stephen, you've taken some really excellent, they're almost like the, you know, media product photos from Apple, but you've photographed all of these iMacs that you've collected and put together some image packages of them, including an animated one. And that's where you really notice this, is that going to this revision of the iMac, there's a little like tuck and lift of the profile.
Yeah.
Like it's going to the gym a little bit.
Well, they did shave 6 pounds out of it. So the big change, right, is that they went from a tray loading optical drive to a slot loading optical drive, which in of itself is not a big deal. But like you said, I agree with you. I think it is like this is the iMac they wanted to make. The whole thing is slightly smaller. You would never know it unless you had two of them or 13 of them.
Or an animated GIF of them.
Yeah, or an animated GIF of them. But you can also, my favorite part about this is you can see through them so much more. So all it, the shielding, and there was actually some electronics on that vertical plane that they got, that they were able to bring horizontally at this time.
And at the announcement, Steve Jobs pulls the same trick that he's done in all of the previous iMac announcements, where he's like, come on, bring out the mobile camera unit and come all the way around this and see just how amazing it looks from all angles. And he like waves his hand behind it. He's like, look, you can see all the way through it. He's very, very excited about the design that they've brought here. One thing that you kind of glossed over, Stephen, was the slot loading CD drive. And it's like, oh, well, that's, you know, it's kind of just what they wanted from the beginning. But I think that that was kind of special at the time, especially on a desktop computer. I mean, it wasn't like people had never seen a slot loading CD drive before, but I know at that point, I think I had pretty much only seen them in car dashboards. And even then, people were kind of like, they had qualms about just like letting the disc go.
I remember using one for the first couple of times. And what I was always worried about is like, well, what happens if I can't get it out? Because the tray one, they actually was like a paperclip hole and you
can command shift one, command shift one.
Yeah. Hit it with a hammer till it comes out. But yeah, it took a little bit of a leap of faith, I guess, to make sure that that hardware worked. On the front too, they made a change where the previous ones, these things had two headphone jacks, because I think the idea, or at least where I used this, was in school. So you have two students listening on separate headphones to the same content. And before this, those two headphone ports were next to the power button. So if you imagine just a kid like rooting around trying to get his headphone port in, or like grabbing it, pulling out, he put the machine to sleep. And so they moved that mercifully to the other speaker away from the power button. And that's just, that's one of those things like I can just imagine that Apple got feedback on that from teachers of saying like this, like, why is the power button here? Please move it. And so there's lots of little details when they changed to the slot loading. One of the big ones that may not be immediately obvious is on the back of the machine. Before this, there was actually a secondary handle that kind of flipped out, so you could get it from the top handle and the bottom handle. Top handle changed on this. They integrated the vents, because remember, this is a Steve Jobs computer, so there's no fans in the iMac G3. It is cooling by physics. And so they changed the way the grill and the handle were put together. I like this design better. But there's also a expansion door on the back, as well as kind of like the back bottom side. So you could open those things and you could get to RAM. You could put an airport card in later. And even later, you could pop that off and there was a VGA port back there. So they're adding expansion and new features to the iMac while keeping the design. You know, if you don't have any of that stuff plugged in, like the VGA door, you could swap it out with a part that left the VGA port exposed all the time. But if you didn't need that, then you could just cover it up. So it's still like keeping this thing like clean and tight and neat. But if you need this other stuff, you know, there's now kind of ways into the machine that weren't here before this.
And that feature of the expansion door is barely still with us on just a couple iMac models today.
Yeah, it's crazy pants. This is where I need to confess something to you guys and to the listeners. And someone called me on this on Twitter when I put that GIF up, and they weren't wrong. It's incorrect for me to say that I have every color of every like permutation of iMac, because the when they went from the trailer to the slot load, like grape and, you know, these five flavor colors did change slightly because the plastic's a little bit thinner. You can see through them better. I don't have those. Like, all my five flavors are tray load.
No, you can't collect the shiny Pokemon. You'll go insane.
Yeah. My family would really be upset with me. And so I don't have those, but there are those like subtle differences. And this is too, where they, for the first time, they split the line where there's not just one model of iMac for sale, where they're sort of good, better, best, right?
Yeah. Still breaking away from the past of Macintosh naming with model numbers. There's still, we get letters here, but there are definitely no numbers. You get your gradations of the product line, and then beyond that, you're into, you know, the realm of build-to-order features as opposed to different models, which maybe would have been like the difference between, oh, it's the 5420 and that's the 5460 a few years prior.
So the cheapest, the good model, was just available in the blueberry. And then the five flavors, the middle tier, were the DV for digital video. There are some cool things like FireWire and that VGA out in the special back door. And then the top level was the DV SE special edition. And this was in a new flavor. Well, you shouldn't need it, but graphite.
Kids, don't eat graphite.
Yeah. And this would be a good time to plug your recent column at iMore. That was really great. A look at every special edition Apple branded product, because this was one of the early ones.
I cannot believe they accepted that pitch. But yeah, so it's you have blueberry at the bottom, then you have the five flavors in the middle and the graphite on top. And so at this point forward, there are some things that stay the same. So DV equals FireWire, digital video. They came with iMovie, I think, installed, but maybe on the disc in the box, but iMovie was involved. Of course, you're talking about a 10 gig hard drive, so you're like shuttling data around all the time. But you have FireWire, so you can plug in your camera. And it's really the beginning of Apple putting that digital hub together and saying, hey, if you buy this machine, it allows you to create things. And to do that in a machine that cost, you know, $1,200 or something was a big deal. And the DV Special Edition, besides coming in graphite, which is super cool looking if you've never seen one, the only difference between it and the DV was an extra 3 gigs of hard drive space. I think maybe a slightly faster CPU, but not really. But that's kind of the gradation Apple's using. And as we see as we go into the next revision, the bottom one is the old DV, DV Plus, which comes next, is the old DV Special Edition. Like, they just kind of bump them down the line.
Oh, the rollback strategy begins.
Yeah, it's like what they do with the iPhones today. Like, that's the easiest thing to compare it to, where I could buy a 6S or an old 6, or until a couple weeks ago, an older 5S. So Apple's experimenting with this stuff as they get into 1999 and 2000. And this is where the family tree gets a little nutty. After this round.
Yeah, one thing to point out here is I think this is the way that it went in terms of the introduction of this model. I know that when Bondi Gate happened a little while ago, I went and wound up watching a whole bunch of iMac product and introduction videos at double speed on YouTube, trying to figure out if someone ever actually said Bondi on stage. And I couldn't find anything, so it was all of us just reading that word and getting it wrong. But in this keynote presentation where the iMac line becomes split up, the way that that's done is with Steve Jobs' patented one more thing. And so the DV was the one more thing. And then the DV Special Edition was even one more thing. And we think of the one more thing as being kind of sacred, always gets a great reaction. And by the time the people who are in that introduction, 2 hours in, get to the DV Special Edition, that's one more thing. And Jobs kind of doesn't like nail the, oh, one more thing. And they're like not having it.
Yeah.
One of the last things I want to say about this big hardware revision is the two itty bitty speakers on the front of the machine were upgraded and now like branded as these are Harman Kardon speakers. And this was one of the biggest things that I was like, why didn't we wait and get this. And because I'm a sucker for marketing, like, for all I know, it probably sounds the same, especially when you're listening to like 64 kilobit MP3s on the machine. It wasn't just that the speakers on their own were upgraded, but that Apple, in conjunction with Harman Kardon, released the iSub, which was like calibrated to work with the two speakers on this machine. And of course, this is the like giant transparent glass blowfish subwoofer that you can still get with the sound sticks. And the idea of that is what like blew my mind. Like, oh my God, this is a computer that has like good enough speakers in it that you can buy a subwoofer and the subwoofer looks just as cool as the computer. And like, I don't have to pump the audio through like my boombox that is also on my desk through an aux cable. And like, that was just like a weird selling point for me. That was probably like a throwaway or, you know, just a single bullet. But I was fixated on like, oh man, this is the computer. Like simultaneously as we are all discovering Napster for Mac and MP3s and having your music on your computer instead of on CDs, like, and this is a computer that has good speakers.
But I think one of the things that speaks to is that it's almost 2 years in to the iMac. And we mentioned that there was that gold rush of blue colored plastic stuff that looked really garbagey. But it took this long for Apple to find one other company that just kind of got it in terms of the design, someone that they could partner with and then sell these things next to each other and say, look, we kind of defined this aesthetic and it's a good one. And it's not just for making all-in-one computers. You can extend this. And Harman Kardon was able to do that. And those speakers, they still look good today.
Oh yeah. And they sound good. The Sage that I had at the beginning, we used to use in our workshop as like an iTunes box, just like remote into it and play music, because they do sound good. And Jobs makes a big deal that you can see them because the bottom part of the case is more translucent and they're spherical. And you know, Apple will actually kind of reuse that design, the technology, in some of the later external speakers with the iMac G4 and the Cube and some of those machines. So it's a beginning of like a multi-year like affair between the two companies. And I think it's, you know, Apple pushing that digital hub, like, you're going to use this for iTunes, you just don't know it yet. You're going to use it to edit your movies, you know, you're going to do all this stuff. This machine is going to become more important to you from a media perspective. So in July 2000, so they're keeping up this pace, right? We go from October 1999 to July 2000. We get the summer 2000 machines, and this is the most complicated. There's four individual models at this point. They're the first iMac to require OS 9. So if you were waiting for the new version of Sherlock, this is the computer you wanted. And it also marks the cheapest an iMac, or really, I think, a Mac maybe ever had gotten.
Yeah, this is the one price in our outline that has an exclamation point after it.
$799.
Yeah, and I've gone through, and unless there were some price drops that I missed, you know, it's kind of hard to see that. You can figure out what the initial selling price of a lot of Macs were. But as far as I can tell, this is the cheapest Mac ever apart from the Mac Mini.
Right, which doesn't come with peripherals and a monitor.
Monitor, keyboard, anything. So this was a really impressive price point. I mean, obviously, inflation carries things ever forward, but it's kind of interesting to see, will Apple ever hit a price point like this again? Are they even interested in hitting a price point like this again, except with maybe something like an iPad?
Yeah, and so $800 got you a 7 gig hard drive. So there's some value engineering going on here. It lacked not only an AirPort card, but actually, I've read mixed things, but I believe that it lacked the slot to put an AirPort card into, which is a little mean. And of course, no FireWire CD-ROM drive instead of DVD-ROM.
Probably no burner in that either.
Yeah, yep, just your reading only. And it came in Indigo, which kind of replaces Blueberry at this point as sort of like the low-end default like color. Like almost every little like specific iMac model after this, you can get an Indigo, which is really nice, like dark blue. But $799 is a big deal, and I think this machine is probably, you know, probably did well in education at that price point, but it was for sale to the general market. You could order one of these from Apple and spend $800 and get yourself an iMac.
Yeah, I think at this point where Indigo became the kind of standard color, The next level up, the iMac DV, was probably the one that my grandpa got, because I remember that it did have FireWire, because he had a analog to digital converter box and hooked it up to VCR, because he had recorded all kinds of stuff on his VCR that he wanted to like preserve and cut clips out of. And that was a major use of that machine, that was a Indigo iMac. And I remember we had that. So we said this was the first iMac to require OS 9. And then when OS 10 came around, I guess we had plenty of space on that like 10 gigabyte hard drive to be able to partition it, and or maybe we didn't even have to partition it and dual boot OS 9, because he wasn't going to learn OS 10 at that point. But I was kind of moving on and wanted to use OS 10 for most things. And it worked fairly well that way. I mean, you know, you just had to take a minute or two to boot from one to the other.
Pick which one you want.
Yeah, he would sometimes come by and be like, oh, can I use the computer for a... Oh, Aqua.
In his defense, OS 9 was probably way faster at that point.
Yeah, especially on a G3.
So that machine came in Indigo or Ruby. The DV Plus, which is a step above it again. The only difference between these machines, speed, hard drive space, you got DVD-ROM at some point. But the DV Plus came in Indigo and Ruby, like the one before it, and then they added Sage. It was the first time that Sage comes in. There's a really great ad with Kermit the Frog with the Sage iMac that I don't even know. I know I have a copy of it. If it's on YouTube, we can make that happen. But there's a great little ad with Kermit talking about how it's not easy being green. And then all the way at the top, at a whopping $14.99, so effectively almost twice as much as the base iMac, is the iMac DV Special Edition Summer 2000. It's a wordy name. 30 gigabyte hard drive, and then graphite and snow. So graphite is still being reserved for the special edition status, and then they add snow to it as well, which snow is one that I had not seen before I set out on this, and it's actually really beautiful. It's not very transparent. They've kind of increased or decrease the opacity. I never know which way the word works. So you can kind of only see through it if there's a light behind it, but it's just a white, like it, not dissimilar from the eMac, of course, but just a really nice looking machine. And that was reserved at that high price point, the top of the line for the year 2000.
Yeah. And this is kind of because of the color palette that they've chosen. Not only just breaking the line into these different named sub-product lines, but kind of taking the iMac and saying some of these iMacs are more pro and some are more consumer. And you know, the more consumer ones have fun colors and the more pro ones have pro colors, just like black and white.
I had not thought about that way, but I think that's definitely right.
And even when you compare all of the colors in this lineup to the previous ones, they all are kind of like more professional versions of their counterparts, like the deeper blue and red and the more like foresty green versus like all the other ones were candy.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to walk in a doctor's office and see like a tangerine iMac sitting on the desk, but you know, a Sage one, you're going to feel a little bit better.
So maybe we should head to the next generation where the colors go totally off the rails and cease becoming colors.
Oh my God. So, early 2001. This is the first time it's important to note that all iMacs have FireWire. So the DV designation goes away because there are no non-DV models. Everything is FireWire now. Everything is VGA out. The price goes back up to $8.99. Speed's a little bit better, but we have to talk about these patterns, these designs. They're not colors. They're molded into the case.
So crazy.
Yeah, so Blue Dalmatian and Flower Power, they are a thing, gentlemen.
And those are the names. Those are the real names.
Yeah. Out of all these iMacs, they've in my opinion, they've aged the least well. And it's kind of obvious to see why if you look at pictures of them. But it really was Apple, I guess, like saying, you know, we can do whatever we want to with these things, right? And you could still go buy an Indigo. Thankfully, or you could go buy a graphite. Indigo and graphite survived this generation. But it is just, it's very odd. And there's lots of little oddities about these machines that they're not transparent. You can't see into them, really. You can, if you shine a light through them, you can see it, but not really. And they are the only two where the Apple, the embedded Apple logo, so there's one at the top and one on the back, those match on all the other 11. So like the Ruby one, it's got a Ruby Apple and they all the same color. Blue Dalmatian and Flower Power use a really pretty like baby blue and then a little bit of a darker blue. And on the Blue Dalmatian and Flower Power, they're opposite. So like the top one is light blue and the back one is dark blue on one of them. And then it's reversed on the second one. So it's, they're not even using the same Apple logo on the top and the back. It's just a really odd, that detail totally escaped me until I had them here. But it's like Apple's just kind of like screwing with the design at this point. And I don't really know why, like at least to my taste, that they're not particularly good looking, but they are unique. They are special.
The Blue Dalmatian is all right. It's kind of a basic pattern. It's in the blue family that, you know, the iMac has traditionally been considered blue. The Flower Power, I don't really know what the inspiration here was. I've said my uncharitable view of what Flower Power looks like, especially from a distance. It looks like something that you left in the back of a fridge for too long. You have to get really close to discern that there are kind of symmetrical flower designs, and they're so overlaid with each other that you just get this kind of pinky, awful color. You know, probably the ugliest thing that Apple had designed prior to this was that that tab color in At Ease.
Were these iMacs the ones that had the slogan "Rip, Mix, Burn"?
Yeah, it may have been the ones right before, but it's definitely in that era where you could, you know, iTunes was in its heyday, right? And you could go buy a CD and rip it and stick it on your iPod, which used FireWire. This is all right in that same time period, if not the exact machines.
Because these kind of also look like someone let the iTunes visualizer design the case. So maybe it was all trying to be tied together. Probably not, because it was very specific. You have this note here in the show notes that I didn't know, that it took 18 months to perfect these designs, to like work on the like molding them into the case and everything.
Yeah, I came across that. I couldn't find a second source, but it seems like it was very intensive. Because if you run your hand over them, all the iMacs are smooth. Some of them have a little texture to them, but these feel markedly different. Because it's not like they're bumpy. It's not like you can tell, like, run your finger around the ridge of one of the flowers, but you can tell the plastic is different. And it's not a vinyl. It's not like, you know, like you see like a van like wrapped in like a Subway logo. Like, it is not that. it is very different from that. And it's clearly it took a long time, according to this one interview I saw. But they're unique, and the sad part to me is they stick around longer than like Ruby and Sage do. Ruby and Sage are locked to one generation, but which is a shame because they're really beautiful. But, you know, this is like, maybe this is like Steve Jobs having no one tell him no. Like, you know, I just know that Steve Jobs loved Flower Power. Like, you can just see it when he announces it. It just seems like something right up his alley. And I don't buy into that. What can you do?
We can move on to the final generation of iMacs is what we can do.
Yeah, so we're now in 2001. No names at this point. It's just you pick your speed and you pick your color. So there's indigo and snow, and then graphite and snow. You can get a graphite or snow for $14.99 with a 700 megahertz G3. Is the best spec iMac G3 ever.
Yeah, specs have come a long way here.
Yeah, very quickly. I mean, you're talking about a 233 in 1998, 2001, you know, 700 megahertz. And this G3 is a better G3 than they had before. We skipped over. They did some L2 cache stuff that no one cares about.
Yeah, or 600 megahertz for the same price as the original iMac, and go from 4 gig to 40 gig hard drive. So, I mean, 10x on storage. I mean, that's pretty much outpacing Moore's Law and everything. These machines were really, you know, this generation moved quickly.
It did. And they brought back the $799 price point for a little while. And what I didn't know until looking into this is that the G3 remained on sale after the iMac G4 was announced and put on sale. And so the G4 was doing its thing, and there was a basically a snow iMac J3 that survived all the way until March of 2003.
That's your free iPhone 4.
But what blows my mind about that is think about how close that was to the Intel transition, where you can still go buy a G3. It's only a couple years past this, really. And you can go in and buy an iMac G3 in the Apple store. They were hitting a price point. I think it was there for education.
Well, and the eMac stuck around for way too long, right?
and that's really what replaced the Snow iMac, kind of not exactly the same price point. But yeah, but it sort of like intellectually, the eMac just slides right in here, especially like weight-wise. But that's, you know, it's a long and complicated road, but in there, Apple's doing a lot of things like we talked about that they do now. They were experimenting with what if we gave each good, better, best a name? And then they got rid of that because I think it was genuinely confusing. It was confusing now, you know, years later trying to unravel it all. But I think it was confusing to the customers wanting to say, I want an iMac. Well, do you want the DV or DV Plus? I have no idea. You were literally just saying letters to me. I don't know what you're saying. And so I think they learned. And by the time 2000, 2001 rolled around, it's like it is now. You go buy a MacBook Air, and it's not MacBook Air level 1, level 2, level 3. You just pick your speed and your other specs, and you get a MacBook Air, right? There's no designation there. And I think that Apple learned that lesson here with this computer.
Or even in that weird, Ruby Sage year, where it's like, I want the green one. Well, the green one only comes at, the higher spec'd version, so you're going to pay more just to have the green one. Almost like the black MacBook.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you wanted that graphite, you were right. It was reserved for people who, you know, maybe needed one in a more professional environment, and the side effect was that it was graphite.
Yeah, one of the interesting things here is just the churn in the models and how quickly things got revised. I mean, the one that blows my mind the most is that the original Bondi iMac only lasted 5-6 months. And then it was gone. But that wasn't an aberration. That was how Apple was developing these and how they were turning them over, Rev-C, Rev-D, and then just getting to labeling them by season and year that they came out.
Yeah, you think about certain models in the Apple lineup today, and we're almost hoping for once a year. That's the best case scenario. It's a given for some. And then there are others like the Mac Mini or the Mac Pro, where it's like, well, we'll wait. We'll wait a couple of years. And this is you could see one more than once a year, an update.
But it was going at a kind of a different strategy because it was looking at not only the specs, but also the style. And they knew that the specs would be a gradual ramp as opposed to with the iPhones now, where you figure, okay, every 2 years we're going to have a major new processor architecture in the iPhone. And I think that this would be something that would be kind of interesting. I don't know, I clearly do not run strategy at Apple, but people have been talking recently about okay, as the iPhone becomes a mature product, is there the need for an annual release? And people say, well, oh my gosh, what if Apple doesn't release a phone every year? They're going to get smoked in the market. Wall Street will hate it. Android will come in and eat their lunch. But what if you said, well, no, we're going to have big milestones every 2 years, the way that we have before, but take 2 years, 24 months and divide it into three. And every 8 months, we're just going to you're going to get slightly tweaked iPhones in all brand new colors. And if they did that every 8 months, especially for, the mass consumer market that, that they've gained with the iPhone, a billion iOS devices, as opposed to the tiny slice of consumer market that they were getting with the iMac, there's kind of a method to the madness here of just constantly pushing, especially when you're looking at those external factors that are more important to many consumers.
And I think too, a big part of that strategy was Apple needed to onboard new customers rapidly. I mean, Apple is really small at this point. They've been through the worst of it. And some of these early keynotes, they're like, hey, we didn't lose $1 billion last quarter. Yay for us. It really was bad. And so I think that doing these constant iterations of, hey, even if it really is the last iMac just remixed a little bit, let's put new colors on it. We'll get rid of that hockey puck mouse at some point. that I think brought people in, that if you were ever thinking about an iMac, it was always in the news, right? There's always new ones. And if you're sensitive to, I don't want to buy something because it's going to be outdated. Well, you know, every 6 months, every 9 months, there's a new iMac, and you can, you know, jump in on that cycle really frequently. And the flip side is the technology didn't really move that quickly, especially like in revisions A through D, that you didn't feel burned if you bought one and all of a sudden there's a new one. Like, they walked that line really well, I think. And it is just a testament to, I think, Apple understanding their customer, that, you know, people, the consumers in particular, really care about things like the case color, that, you know, if you're really into blue, you're really going to like this new indigo. And that is really important to a large set of people. You know, as nerds, I think it's easy for us to sort of turn our noses up at that, but this is the formula. They were perfecting this formula that they reused in the iPod Nano and the iPod Mini before it, right? It's the same principle. It's a lot of fast iteration, and you get to pick your color. You get to express yourself through your purchase. And this is the proving ground for all of that stuff that Apple still does today.
Absolutely. I mean, we just saw that with the latest revision to the MacBook, where they added the rose gold finish, as they call it now. It's not just a color. Color is, you know, that's not fancy enough. It's the finish. But they added that color, and the reaction to that broke down into basically three camps. There was the consumer camp, people who thought, hey, that looks cool, I would really like to have one of those. There was the Apple is doomed, and this is a terrible, sucky revision, and they should have never done this in the first place. And then there were those of us who have been tracking this all along and try to get this historical perspective, who go, well, this was kind of a nice, like, mid-cycle rev. And I think Jason Snell just published a review, like a sat down thoughtful review instead of like hot takes on that revision, and says, yeah, like, they upped the specs. It looks pretty much the same. They gave a little something extra to the people who aren't carefully monitoring the specs, and they're moving forward. Same kind of model.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's why this machine is important historically, is that so much of what Apple's playbook is now, they were figuring all that out in this machine and for these years. And what's really astounding to me, when you guys put in the show notes, was they did this without Apple stores. The Apple store didn't open until 2001. And even then, you had to live in one of about six towns to be in one. So, you know, people who bought these things either bought them online, and that became increasingly important, but I think that was very novel at the beginning. But people bought them at CompUSA's and Sears and like all these like non-Apple environments.
You got the MacMull catalog in the mail, and you called up the clip art lady who was in the corner of every page. And that was actually literally how we ordered that Indigo iMac, was from MacMull. I actually remember sitting in my grandparents' house, like, with, like, we had circled in the catalog, and we called them and we said, send this to this address.
It's crazy. It seems so wild now, but they did this without all that retail support that they have now. And that's impressive too, that they sold as many as they did and they supported them as well as they did, and out in a very different environment.
Yeah. Thinking about that, I kind of imagined the alternate universe where Apple retail existed a little bit earlier. And just trying to imagine what an Apple store would look like at launch of, say, like the Five Flavors iMacs.
Yeah, it'd be very colorful.
And just how, just like the way that they would lay that out in the way that matches their marketing material and what we know now as the way an Apple store operates. And, you know, that seems like a very powerful image, but it was one that just didn't exist. So I think that brings it to the end of the iMac G3 cycle. Just to kind of wrap up where it went from there, you know, the next step was the iMac G4. And this was the big design shift finally away from CRT Macs. So the iMac G4, my family did have one of these, often endearingly known as the iLamp.
Yeah.
you know, get away from that CRT as being the central feature. Now we can have a flat panel display as the central feature. And what do you do with that? Well, you put it on an articulating arm, which, you know, to this day, I kind of wish that I had sometimes. And it was, you know, some people will mount their entire iMac on like a Visa mount arm to get that same kind of functionality that came to the iMac with the iMac G4. And then the rest of the product line also transitioned to the G4. You had the G4 Towers, the G4 Cube. They adopted, you know, they were pro and they adopted that graphite color palette, going away from the blueberry Mickey Mouse G3 Tower. And that was the way forward, was with these flat panel displays, also releasing the cinema displays that would be flat panels to go with your other desktop Macs.
Yeah, this whole thing we've been talking about, these colors and the design, were really possible because of the CRT. And it was, I guess, Johnny Ive and his team saying, you know what, we might as well just embrace this and like show it off in a way that doesn't hide the fact that we're, you know, stuck with this technology for a little while longer.
Yeah, and there were other things that were pointing towards the move away from CRT. The 20th anniversary Macintosh predated the move to LCD flat panel displays, but had it kind of resembles what the iMac eventually became, with the hemisphere base and the separate articulating arm for the display, although kind of sitting next to each other on the desk, almost even a little bit more like the Cube plus a cinema display.
Or the sub that Brian lusted after so badly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a big shift to the G4, and but the way they approach it is like these later G3s, where it's like there's not an iMac G4 DV, like they're all the same, and you just pick a speed and eventually a screen size.
And I think there were some final things we wanted to talk about, and regarding the iMac G3's larger impact on pop culture, consumer electronics culture, and so on.
Yeah, so of course there were the copycats that came out shortly after the iMac. It happens with pretty much every Apple product these days. They spend years and years really refining their design and then putting something out to the world. And other manufacturers go, oh, well, if we just kind of make it look like that, we'll really have everything that they do, right?
Not that easy.
And the famous one, I think we mentioned this perhaps in an earlier episode, was the eMachines all-in-one Windows PC that sold for something like $400, that they slapped some blue plastic panels on the side. And basically, you know, Apple's argument was they were just trying to fool people into thinking, oh, well, this is like an iMac, and getting them to buy it instead. There was a big lawsuit there that goes into weird parts of IP law involving trade dress. So you can't like copyright the design of the machine. And they hadn't actually infringed on any of Apple's patents, but there was this additional recourse for them to say, well, you're really, really just trying to fool people.
The Wikipedia picture of this thing is like, it's like a bizarro world iMac.
It's got like hard lines.
That's not good.
Yeah.
The mouse is probably better though.
Yeah, but you have to plug it into the right serial port. Like, is it purple or is it green?
Yeah, and of course, I mean, you guys covered it really well in your previous episode, but this whole design language like sums up so much of the late 90s. Like, you could go buy an alarm clock that was translucent colored plastic. I mean, it was this set, this defined consumer electronic design for several years. And I don't think Apple does that as much today. They still do it in the consumer space, or in the technology space. But like, I'm not, you know, I just had to replace small appliance in our kitchen, and it isn't like gleaming white plastic with like aluminum, right? Like, not everyone follows this as closely as they did, but I think the iMac was so different and instantly just so attractive that everybody was just drawn to it.
Yeah, well, and Apple sold it as kind of the centerpiece of your future home. You know, it was your digital hub, and the future was digital. Everything in your home was going to be digital. And so it made sense that everybody wanted to orbit around that. Whereas today, yeah, we've got computers everywhere. We've got magic pocket computers. We've got computers on our desks. We've got computers in our backpacks. And so they just blend in, and you can, thankfully, companies can design in their own right. And of course, there were also the fictional copycats. One of my favorites is in the comic strip Foxtrot. There's a iMac-like computer that is called the iFruit, which looks like a pear. It even has a leaf on the top, but it's a giant CRT monitor. It kind of looks like if you took an took one of the CRT iMacs and just turned it like face down with the screen facing down. That's the design of it. But, you know, came in all of the fruit colors, and the running gag in the strip is that Jason, the son, is like super nerd, and the computer is almost too friendly for him, and his mom always wants to hug it. and Bill Amond was who's the creator of Foxtrot, was like a longtime Mac user. I remember getting in trouble in school for playing hacked versions of games that he created. He took a version of Joust for the classic Mac and replaced all the resources in ResEdit to make Slugman the video game, which was circulating on many floppy disks in our elementary school.
And I think the iFruit in Foxtrot like kept pace with Apple's iMac designs. Like they got the flat panel iFruit G4 and then the like aluminum back to the computer electronics or behind the glass iFruit.
It's a heck of a running joke.
Anything else before we wrap up these delicious fruit-flavored iMacs?
I think that about covers it.
Well, we think that you have about covered them, Stephen. So one thing that we'll have in the show notes is I know you've put a sort of a central hub over on 512 Pixels where you're collecting all of the things that you've done with this amazing physical collection that you've gotten into your office. Much to the dismay of your family, including, I think, your brother, who was threatening them with a knife today.
Yeah, we share an office, and he's like, what are you doing? So,
well, thank you for sharing this with us. And I know that you said that you were happy to talk to us because some of your co-hosts at Relay kind of glaze over when you start talking about how much VRAM was in a particular revision of G3 iMac, and we enjoy it, and we hope our listeners did as well.
Yeah, I won't say who, but Federico does.
He's all iPad. I understand. He's the future man here. You know, 20 years from now, when we're doing the comprehensive history of the iPad, he'll be the one who's explaining it all to us.
He's your man for the job.
You can find the show notes for this episode. We're going to link to all that stuff on our website at simplebeep.com. All of our episodes are at simplebeep.com/episodes. Any feedback for us, you can send it through the website or find us over on Twitter. The show account is @simple_beep. You can find each of us individually on Twitter as well. I'm at ecormany, ecormany.
And I'm at bsuto, bsuto.
And Stephen?
I'm at ISMH.
All right. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.